This is called Self-Inquiry by Kui Saparabit. Q-U-I-S. And he's got all these dots before the name.
Diacritical marks?
No. It's called, what is it called? The
ellipses?
Ellipses, mm-hmm. Yeah. Got about 10 of those before his name.
Must be a noun to put it in.
The devotees of Sri Bhagavan are spread all over the world. It is impossible to contact them individually. I'm writing this piece through the mountain path, but it is really written in a perennial way, a personal way, as if to each one separately. Okay. Got that straight. The sage says, in all possible difficulties or problems, personal, domestic, even political or religious, inquire for whom the problem exists. By this honest, serious inquiry, we go deep inside and come to a point which is really, in the beginning, a conceptual self, a self of mentation, and not the real self. The real self, or simply the self, cannot be reached or experienced in the sense in which we experience something, because it is beyond the trifold phenomenon of experiencer, experience, and experienced, or seer, sight, and seen. The sage simply says, inquire. And here lies the crux of the matter. Though we say, as we have read and heard, that self is the source, we ourselves have not actually found it so, because our preconceived ideas come between. Our ideas of the self are certainly not the self. We suppose that it is the self that we are coming to, but it is certainly not the self, though later we may reach that state. I will try to explain. Our grief or yearning for something, in short, our problem, brings us to the conceptual self, to our theory of a self. But eventually, the real, call it self, comes into being, or rather, that ever-existent comes into our experiencing. But this is not experiencing of the trifold experience being. Many of us get stuck in the conceptual self and never reach this nature referred to above, of knower knowledge known. It is direct experience, thus get nowhere. Devotees of Sri Ramana Maharshi should see with an open mind. Devotees of Sri Ramana Maharshi who are really sincere and want to tread the path propounded by him. If I can offer a helping hand, a friend's hand, if any find it of no use, they can leave it. If any find it useful, it may serve for dotting the I's and crossing the T's of the original teaching. There's a thing to be understood in oneself, privately, each one for himself. It's not a matter for discussion.
Oh, okay. Keep your thoughts to yourself.
Another chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, translated by G.V. Professor Kulkarni and Arthur Ashbourne, Chapter 4. Sri Bhagavan said, I proclaimed this imperishable yoga to Vivasvan, he to Manu, and Manu to Ikshavaku. Note, this is the tradition of the Gita teaching. Vivasvan is the sun god. His son, Manu, is the founder of the human race.
It's Vivaswan, I think.
Vivaswan.
Vivaswan.
Oh, Vivaswan. His son, Manu, is the founder of the human race. Manu's son, Ikshvaku, was a famous king of the Solar Dynasty, too. Thus handed down by tradition, the royal sages knew it. O scourge of the foe, until it was lost through long lapse of time. Note, two important points arise from this verse. One is that the transmission is through royal or kshatriya, not Brahmin sages. Okay, good, Malini's not here. Tell her, not here.
Well, the Solar Dynasty is Sri Ram's dynasty. Mm. Yeah.
Well, he's a kshatriya.
Yes, he.
And in this connection, it is to be remembered that Rama and Krishna were both of royal descent, as outside Hinduism were Buddha and Christ also. The second point is the affirmation continued in verses 3, 7, and 8 that religion, far from progressing, declines and needs periodical renewal. 3. Today, this same ancient yoga, the supreme secret, have I expounded to you, because you are my worshipper and friend. 4. Arjuna said, later was your birth, earlier that of Vivaswan. How then am I to understand that you originally proclaimed this to him? Bhagavan said, many births of mine have gone by, and of yours too, Arjuna. I know them all, while you do not, O scourge of the foe. That's what Jesus said. Before Abraham,
I am.
I was.
No, I am.
I am.
Yeah.
I am. 6. Unborn and eternal self though I am, Lord of all beings though I am, yet resorting to my nature, Prakriti, I take birth through my own power, Maya. Note, Prakriti is nature in the sense of universal substance, undifferentiated, primordial, virgin, and the mother of all. Maya is illusion, but also the power that creates illusion. Here and in the next two verses is enunciated the doctrine of avatars. An avatar is not an ordinary mortal making karma or struggling to get free from karma, but a divine incarnation assuming the appearance of human limitation for the welfare of mankind. 7. Whatever dharma decays in adharma, whenever dharma decays and adharma prevails, O Bharata, I manifest myself, A, for the protection of the good, for the destruction of the evil, and for the establishment of dharma. I take birth from age to age. 9. He who thus rightly knows my divine birth and activity is not reborn on leaving the body, Arjuna, but comes to me. Note, this is an enunciation of Jnana Marga, the path of knowledge. It is obvious that liberation cannot come from mere knowledge or a belief in a historical fact. A deeper meaning must be sought. He who realizes the immersion of the uncontaminable spirit in the apparent contaminable contamination of individual life, an action cannot be encased again in the ignorant state of individual being, but unites with the spirit. 10. Many have there been who, free from attachment, fear, and anger, absorbed in me and taking refuge in me, have been purified by the austerity, tapas, of wisdom, and have attained my state. Note, the term translated here and in the following verses as wisdom is jnana, meaning knowledge, in the sense of divine certitude, not mere mental understanding. 11. In whatever way men approach me, in that way I do come to them. All paths that men follow are paths to me, O son of Pritha. 12. Those who seek success in their actions here sacrifice to the gods, for action yields fruit speedily in this world. 13. The fourfold order of society I created on the basis of man's qualities and actions. Yet though I am its author, know me to be inactive and immutable. The Chaturvarnya is a fourfold division of society into Brahmins or priests, Kshatriyas or warriors, Vaishyas or merchants, and agriculturalists, and Shudras. No, that's the fifth one, right? Shudra or labor.
Shudra is the fourth. Shudra is the fourth.
No, one of the priests, Kshaya, warriors, Vaishyas. Well, you have the Kshatriyas, you have the Brahmins, you have the Vaishyas. Okay, we're giving another. Laborers.
Yeah.
Natural propensities are said to have decided a man's caste at the beginning. Later, they may become hereditary. 14. Activity does not contaminate me, nor have I any craving for its fruit. He who knows this of me is not bound by activity. Here again, the deeper meaning of me must be grasped. It is not knowing or believing the historical Krishna to have been such and such that can liberate a man, but realizing his own true self to be such. 15. Safe in this knowledge, the ancients who sought liberation engaged in activity. Do we also therefore engage in activity as the ancients did of old? 16. What is activity and what is inactivity? About this, even the wise are confused. I will explain to you what activity is, knowing which you will be freed from evil. 17. Activity has to be understood, also wrong activity, also inactivity. The nature of activity is hard to understand. 18. He alone is wise, he is a yogi, he has accomplished all activity, who sees inactivity, inactivity, and activity in inactivity. No. That is to say, who sees detached activity to be inactivity, and more attention from action to be activity. And mere abstention from action to be activity. It is to be noted how this tallies with the Taoist teaching of Wei Wu Wei, inactive activity. 19. One whose undertakings are all free from desire and whose activity has been purified in the flame of wisdom is termed a sage by those who know. 20. Indifferent to the fruits of actions, ever content and utterly independent, he is inactive, even while engaged in activity. 21. One who engages in activity with his body only, without desire, controlled in heart and mind, having renounced possessions, incurs no sin. 22. Satisfied with what comes to him by chance, beyond the pairs of opposites, free from envy, equal in success and failure, he is not bound by his actions. 23. The activity of one who is detached and set free, whose mind is stabilized in wisdom, whose action is sacrifice, is entirely dissolved. 24. The act of offering is Brahman. The oblation is Brahman. The fire in which it is offered is Brahman. The offerer himself is Brahman. By acting with his mind fixed ever on Brahman, a man becomes Brahman. 25. Some yogis offer sacrifice to the gods. Others sacrifice self itself in the fire of Brahman. No, this is interpreted by Shankaracharya to mean that some perform sacrificial rites in order to gain their desired ends, while others sacrifice the self to the self. Some yogis offer hearing and the other senses in the fire of restraint. Others offer sound and other sense objects in the fire of the senses. Note, the first half of this verse is clear, that some discipline their senses by constant control. The second half is usually taken to mean that some renounce the objects that might excite the senses. 27. Others again offer the activity of the senses and that of the vital force and the fire of sense control kindled by wisdom. 28. Others there are who, under strict vow, sacrifice by means of their possessions, their austerities, their yoga, their learning, and their knowledge. No. That is to say, that some sacrifice by renouncing their possessions, some by performing austerities, some by yogic disciplines, some by concentration and scriptural texts, and some by fixing the mind in a state of knowledge. 29. Some offer the exaltation into the inhalation, or the inhalation into the exhalation, or restrain both inhalation and exhalation, concentrating the breath on breath control. Note, this refers to three techniques of breath control. 30. Some, regulating their diet, offer the life breath into the life breath. All these understand the meaning of sacrifice and expiate their sins by it. 31. Those who eat the sacred remnants after sacrifice attain to the eternal Brahman. Success in this world is not for those who make no sacrifice, how much less in another world, or best of kurus. No. In this verse, the term sacrifice must have had the meaning ritualistic burnt offering at the time when the Gita was proclaimed. But it also had then, and still has, the meaning of restraint and giving up. The sacred remnants after sacrifice can be taken not only literally but also symbolically as a legitimate activity that remains when practicing self-control. The reference to success in this world has a twofold meaning. that only dedicated activity succeeds, and that only he who can subordinate lesser to greater purpose succeeds. 32. Thus, many forms of sacrifice are expounded in the scriptures. Know that all of them derive from activity. Knowing this, you shall attain liberation. 33. Greater than all material sacrifice is a sacrifice through wisdom, O scourge of the foe. All activity without exception, O son of Pritha, culminates in wisdom. 34. Gain this knowledge by bowing down to your guru, by questioning him, and by serving him. The wise who have realized the truth will teach you knowledge. 35. Know this, and you will never fall thus into confusion, O son of Pandu. Through this knowledge, you will see all beings in the self and also in me. Note, this indicates a twofold mode of comprehension, non-theistic and theistic, to see all beings in the self and in God. 36. Even were you the greatest of sinners, yet should you cross over all evil on this raft of knowledge. 37. As a well-lit fire consumes its fuel, Arjuna, so does the fire of knowledge reduce all activities to ashes. 38. There is nothing in the world so purifying as knowledge. One who is well-grounded in yoga discovers this in course of time, in himself, for himself. 39. One who has faith and concentration and has subdued his senses attains knowledge. Having gained knowledge, he speedily attains supreme peace. 40. But one who is in a state of ignorance, lacking faith, and doubting, perishes. Neither this world nor that beyond falls to the doubter, nor does happiness. Note. Ignorance here does not mean mere lack of information. It is ajnana, the negation of jnana, for which, see the note in verse 10. By faith and concentration, certitude can be attained, as stated in the previous verse. But one who lacks both certitude and faith is left with no boat to cross the flood, swept hither and thither by doubts and sense attractions. 41. He who has surrendered activity through yoga, who has destroyed doubts by certitude, and who is self-possessed, O wealth winner, is not bound by actions he performs. 42. Therefore, with the sword of knowledge, cut down this doubt born of ignorance that dwells in your heart. Stand firm in yoga. Rise up, O heart. Here ends the fourth chapter entitled The Yoga of Knowledge. Obituary. They put Somerset Maugham's obituary in here.
Oh.
1966. I don't know why. Although by no means dedicated to a spiritual life, the late Somerset Maugham was one of those who helped to make the Maharshi widely known. You heard of him?
Raises.
Yeah. I saw the movie, was made in the 40s. Mm-hmm. This Tyrone Power was the actor. Yeah. I heard of him. Mm-hmm. When I was a teenager, maybe 14 or so, I saw that television, the movie. I remember sitting by myself watching the movie.
I've never seen it.
And then I thought, wow, you don't have to do everything that everybody else is doing.
That was the movie.
You don't have, you can, you know, go out and find something else. So there's some other truth besides, you know, going to college, getting married, having children, going to have a job, retiring, all that. There's some other idea. There's some other ideal.
It was a movie that... Yeah. It's on YouTube, I think.
Is it?
The Tyrone Power, the first one.
Yes.
He was alive.
And then I think it's
and you know, they showed he went to, like, he fashioned the guru in that movie after Bhagavan, and that book.
Yeah.
And even in the movie, they had a sage there, you know, and but he had a beard and everything, and there's a mountain behind him.
Oh.
In the movie, you know. They tell him to go up in the mountain and meditate. He tells Tyrone Power to go up in the mountain and meditate. So he goes up in the mountain. But he fashioned that guru after Bhagavan in the book.
Yeah. He got very sick and he in Peru. And
not sick, he passed out.
Oh.
And people thought he went to space. No, he just had like a something he happened to him.
Or Samadhi.
Even Major Chak was very upset with him. Why? Because he came to Tiruvannamalai not to see Bhagavan but to see Major Chadwick.
Oh.
Because he thought, here's a Britisher living in some hermitage, and he wanted to write this book, this Razor's Blade.
Uh-huh.
He had this always in his mind about someone being discontent with the Western life,
uh-huh,
and going in spiritual service, going uh-huh in somewhere in India and giving up everything. So he had that in the back of his mind for writing a book, and so he thought, this is the guy he's going to see. So Chadwick was very upset because he kept asking him questions about his life.
Oh.
Someone told him about Chadwick when he was in Madras.
Okay.
So then he went, and he was upset. He came even with some wine or something for lunch. They came, brought lunch.
French wine.
You know, Louis Bust was in depth, you know, finding out everything about that.
Oh.
And Major Chadwick, you know, he wrote on Bhagavan, he called the saint a little bit.
Mm.
And Chadwick just tears the whole, you know, essay apart. Although by no means dedicated to a spiritual life, the late Somerset Maugham was one of those who helped to make Maharshi widely known. Just because he visited there, because he was the most popular author at that time,
the most famous
author in the world at that time,
mm-hmm,
in English language.
Awesome.
So just the fact that he visited Ramana Maharshi. Mm-hmm. He came for a brief visit in 1939, after which he wrote the novel The Razor's Edge, presenting a highly rationalized, fictionalized picture of Bhagavan. Toward the end of his life, in the points of view, he gave an account of the principal influences on his life, and one chapter of the book entitled The Saint was about Bhagavan. Since various stories of his visit here have been put abroad, we quote here that given by Major Chadwick from his own first-hand observation in his book, A Sadhu's Reminiscences of Ramana Maharshi. You know, he fashioned that character after Major Chadwick.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. You know, he came with all kinds of theories, but actually it was Major Chadwick. And that, you know, raises it. In March 1939, Somerset Maugham came to the ashram. Many accounts have been given, this is Chadwick writing, of his visit, and all of them different. As I was the principal person concerned in looking after him, I have decided to give my own version. He was brought to the ashram by a friend of mine, Miss Austin, wife of the collector of Madras. The party had first gone to the dak bungalow to have their lunch, but finding it full, had come on to the ashram. They asked me whether I could find somewhere for them where they could have the meal they had brought with them. I arranged for one of the small rooms near my own, as I had already had my meal. At their request, I sat and talked with them while they ate. Somerset Maugham asked innumerable questions about my life and the ashram, apologizing for his inquisitiveness. You know, he's collecting material for his book, you know. And he... Even in his book, he said, you know, all these, this is a factual story. the person still alive who I'm writing about. He's concealing his identity, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he himself is in the novel, you know, meeting this person now and then. But that's all fictional. Quote, at the end of the meal, which they had taken on the veranda, with Somerset Maugham sitting more or less in the sun, he fainted. Many absurd stories were circulated to account for this, that he had seen Bhagavan and this was a state of samadhi brought on by the meeting and such alike. Actually, he had not seen Bhagavan at all. He was probably had a slight sunstroke, though he himself said that he had been liable to such blackouts occasionally since birth. We carried him to my room and laid him on my bed. I then went to Bhagavan and told him what had happened and asked him, when he went out for his stroll about 2 o'clock, to come to my room and see Somerset Maugham, who was now unfit to come to the hall. And Bhagavan agreed. I met Bhagavan on the way, and as we approached my room, Somerset Maugham was just coming out. He said that he now felt better and was on his way to the hall. I told him to go back into the room and sit down, as Bhagavan had come to him there instead. Bhagavan and Somerset Maugham sat opposite to each other for about half an hour, without uttering a word, at the end of which Somerset Maugham looked nervously across in my direction and said, "Is there any need to say anything?" "No," replied Bhagavan. Bhagavan said, "No." Silence is best. Silence is itself conversation. Bhagavan said that in English. After some further period, Bhagavan turned to me in his childlike way and said, "I think I had better be going. They will be looking for me," as no one in the ashram knew where he had gone except the attendant, who always accompanied him. This was correct. The interview lasted about 45 minutes. After Bhagavan had returned to the hall, the rest of the party remained in my room for tea. After tea, Somerset Maugham, who was wearing a large pair of boots, wanted to go to the hall and see where Bhagavan usually lived. I took him to the western window, through which he looked for some time with interest, making mental notes. He says in his indifferent and quite uninspired article, The Saint, published in a series of essays 20 years after the event, that he sat in the hall in Bhagavan's presence, but this is untrue, because he could not enter with his boots. He only gazed into the hall from outside. He also tacked a certain amount of philosophy onto Bhagavan, which Bhagavan could never have uttered in his life. But such is the habit of famous authors, to put their own opinions into the mouths of others. In this recent article, Somerset Maugham says that because of his fainting fit, which some Indians regard as a high state of samadhi, which he denies, he has been sent a mass of literature concerning the Maharshi. This may be true, but it is certainly true that he wrote to the ashram and told them that he was going to write about Bhagavan and ask for as much material as they could send. So here's the obituary of Bhagavan's sister here also, Alamelu, she died in 1953. Well, this is another Alamelu. Srimati Alamelu Amal was a familiar figure at the ashram, where she could be seen working in the temple morning and evening. She passed away on the 15th, at the age of 75. This is another Alamelu, not Bhagavan's sister. They have the obituary of Swami Yatishwarananda. I don't know if you know, he's a Ramakrishna order Swami.
Oh.
I first read about Advaita Vedanta, his book, maybe before. In our previous issue, we had to note the passing of the president of the Ramakrishna Mutt Mission. In this issue, we have to record that he had been closely followed by the Vice President, Swami Yatheswarananda. Born in Bengal in 1889, the Swami became a disciple of Swami Brahmananda Maharaj, one of the direct disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. He became widely known as a writer and editor, an administrator and a spiritual guide. Not only did he hold high positions in the Order of India, but he represented it in various foreign countries, including England and the USA. He has been its vice president since 1962. From 1950 up to the time of his death, he was the president of its Bangalore, of the Bangalore branch. You know, there's a book there, Meditation, Spiritual Life. Really, have you seen it?
Yeah.
It's a real good book. I read it twice.
Fat one.
Yeah. All his. Here they have the obituary, Sadhu Vaswani.
Oh.
This is the uncle
the
of that.
Senior one.
But he's the uncle of that Dada Vaswani.
Yeah, J.P. Vaswani.
And they want to visit Bhagavan. Yeah.
He did. He's dead.
The Sadhu Vaswani went with his nephew, with his Dada Vaswani. Sadhu Vaswani, who passed away on January the 16th at the age of 87, was a widely known and much loved figure. Most of his life had been devoted to spiritual and cultural teaching. For many years past, he had been publishing his reflections in the form of a periodical. He had a wide circle of followers with whom we sympathize. No, they're from Sindhi. They're Sindhi family.
Yes,
and all these Sindhi, a lot of Sindhi people are devotees of this. Vaswani.
Yeah,
his nephew also, Dada Vaswani. He died, he was almost 100 or something, right?
Yeah. It's very sad. Sindh, you know, Pakistan, is not one temple. And all the Sindhi Brahmins were like, so there's not one Brahmin left in the Sindhi. Yeah. Very sad.
There's not one Brahmin?
No, I'm Sindhi community. This was told to me by a Sindhi, you know. She lives in Delaware.
What do you mean?
They had a Brahmin community, but they were all killed by the Muslims. And no temple in Punjab and Sindh. All the temples were
destroyed.
Never. I didn't know about this until this lady told me. She was around 76 years old, she was telling. Even now she gets into trouble because her birthplace is Pakistan. So they give her trouble.
Oh, it's about, okay. Yeah. But she has an Indian passport, though,
right? No, she has a
US.
American passport.
Oh, they ask, where are you born?
Born.
They ask, but even if you have a US passport, they ask you?
Well, you know. Sometimes you get into trouble like that. Now, if you go back, the visa expired, my nephew's wife, I went for the baby shower, right? The mother came, he said, "Why, you just went back, why are you back here?" She didn't tell, she told that my daughter is pregnant, I came to help. We'll take care of your daughter.
So here's a quote from Bhagavan. I ask you to observe where the eye arises in your body, but it is not really quite correct to say that the eye arises from and emerges in the chest at the right side. The heart is another name for the reality, and this is neither inside nor outside the body. There can be no in or out for it, since it alone is. I do not mean by heart any physiological organ, or any plexus or nerves, or anything like that. But so long as a man identifies himself with the body, or thinks he is the body, he is advised to see where in the body the I thought arises and merges again. It must be the heart at the right side of the chest, since every man of whatever race and religion and whatever language he may be speaking points to the right side of the chest to indicate himself when he says, I. This is so all over the world. So that must be the place. And by keenly watching the emergence of the I thought and waking and its subsidence and going to sleep, one can see that it is in the heart on the right side. When a room is dark, you need a lamp to light it. But when the sun rises, there is no need for a lamp. Objects are seen without one. And to see the sun itself, no lamp is needed because it is self-luminous. Similarly with the mind, the reflected light of the mind is necessary to perceive objects. But to see the heart, it is enough for the mind to be turned towards it. Then the mind loses itself and the heart shines forth. And a little note on Bhagavan. They have a big article on Analysis of the Horoscope of Maharshi Ramana by Banerjee in Bengali. But there's a little note here. Astrological note by V.T. Sheshadri. Maharshi Ramana's Jupiter is in the sixth bhava, which indicates that orthodoxy will not be strictly observed. Not only that, but he is in his dignity and therefore the ruler of the sixth, showing the splendor and success with which orthodox rules were modified. And in fact, we see that Bhagavan did not take sannyas or observe the letter of the Shastric law, although he embodied the spirit of it. Mars is in the eighth bhava and controls the first, fifth, and ninth. For a single planet to control these three is a rare thing. Kuja is Lord Subramanya, the commander-in-chief of the gods. The Deva Senapati. So no wonder that some of Bhagavan's disciples worshipped him as an avatar of Lord Subramanya. It is said in the scriptures that Subramanya emerged from Agni, fire. Similarly, Sri Bhagavan is the fire for the purification of his followers.
So is this weekend going to be cold? Is that it?
No, it's going to be warm up, but this next couple of days going to be real cold.
Yeah. It says it's just warming here, but it's
56.
53.
Yeah, we have 56. 55. It was 55. Now it's 56. It went up a little bit.
Yeah, 53 where I am. But I see with the storm warnings all over.
It's going to rain, they say.
They've already sanded the floors, the roads there.
I have to go on the bicycle this afternoon and see if I run into it. But it's supposed to get precipitously cold real fast now.
Oh.
Yeah.
My nephew went to Chicago for an interview.
Yeah, it's already there.
I think he's stuck. He's supposed to come back today. I don't know whether
they're having snow and everything.
They canceled all the flights.
Oh, wow. It's a little early for a flight.
But it's going to be sunny out. It's going to clear up. This morning we may get some rain up to around 1 o'clock. I was just looking at this morning. May get some little rain. And then it's getting colder and colder, but I think it's pretty clear. We're not going to get the snow, I don't think.
They had snow, Chicago, Detroit.
Mm-hmm. But if the rain comes and then it freezes on the road, that's a problem.
Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah. I prefer
snow over the ice.
This weekend my family is coming.
What day?
Thursday.
There's me.